warm welcome to you. My name is Chris Fishlock. I'm on the leadership team here, and it's great to be able to welcome so many people to our Summerlink evening. Now, can I just say at the start, if you're with the IGG Seekers Group or the Big Picture Group, then you're in the wrong place. You need to move and find one of the rooms. One of the stewards can show you where to go. The room just sort of connected to the church. They'll show you where to go. We'll be having a break in about a minute's time for discussion. You could slip out there. Nobody would notice. Now, for the rest of us, if this is your first time with us at Summerlink, we meet through the summer to stay in contact with each other and, most importantly, to learn from the living God as we read his word and gather around it together, discussing and then praying. Our regular small groups don't carry on through the summer, and so we just meet once a week like this for Summerlink. I'm really glad you could make it this evening. There'll be new people sitting around your tables, perhaps people that you're not familiar with. In just a moment, it'd be a good chance to spend a little bit of time just introducing yourself to each other around the tables as we kick off our discussion in Exodus 3. Just before we get to Exodus 3, though, you'll see an opening question on the handouts. Do turn to that after you've introduced each other. We've got about 10 minutes or so to discuss that opening question, and then I'll draw us back together. Just before we launch off on all of those different tasks, why don't I lead us in an opening prayer? Heavenly Father, we praise you and thank you for the real privilege of being able to meet together freely as your people. As we consider now what you have to say through the book of Exodus, please speak to us through your word. May the discussion that we have round table be really useful, and may we leave here challenged and equipped to live life in this world for your glory. Amen. I'll draw us back together in about 10 minutes or so. Okay, if I could just draw us back together. Do you grab a Bible? You'll see them hopefully on the tables in front of you, and turn to Exodus chapter 3. You find that on page 55. It's a good opportunity for me to alert you to a serious misprint in the ESV Bibles. You'll see the chapter 3 heading, The Burning Bush. Well, I put the correct title at the top of your handout, The Not-So-Burning Bush, which is what we are considering this evening. And I'm going to read some of those verses in just a few minutes. I love the story I heard some years ago of a five-year-old girl who was drawing a picture in her classroom. Her teacher came up to her and said, that looks very interesting. What is it you're drawing? The little girl said, I'm drawing a picture of God. The teacher was a little put out and said, But that's impossible. No one knows what God looks like. The little girl replies, well, they will do when I'm finished. I hope as the opening discussion drew out just now, we are limited somewhat in what we can know about God. The created world gives us a huge amount of general information about God's hidden attributes, his sort of power, his design skills. But that's where it ends. It's hardly surprising, is it, that some cultures have ascribed some of these amazing attributes that we see around us in the world to things that they can see. So the ancient Egyptians, they could see the sun, and they gave it the name Ra, and they worshipped it, and they said, Ra is all-powerful. We can see this God. The Canaanites, people that were around at the time that Exodus was written, they saw the thunder and lightning and rain, and they gave it a name. They called this God, the God Baal, gave it their devotion. And then, of course, as many will know, in Madagascar, in an effort to appease the powerful god of the volcano, King Julian tried to push that little bush baby in. And there's a few people over there writing notes. You don't want to write that down. But when it comes to specific details about the true creator God, his character, his plans for this world, and his personal attributes, well, we are left guessing unless God reveals himself to us. The created world does not, cannot give us the full picture. And this section of Exodus was written to help us understand a little bit more about God's personal attributes, his personal characteristics. It's very popular today, isn't it, to say things like, I like to think of God like... dot, dot, dot. Or sometimes, for me, my God is like... dot, dot, dot. Well, Christians don't need to do that, because God has made himself known to his people. Statements like that are often driven by people with personal agendas. And the God of the Bible has his own agenda. And our job, our privilege, is to get to know that God. He's done it very carefully over thousands of years. He didn't just sort of reveal himself and leave it like that. His revelation lasted for many thousands of years, carefully recorded by different men and women over that period, slowly building a picture for us to grasp. Not a picture of the way he looks, but a picture, much more importantly, of what he is like and what he has planned. Look at Exodus 3. I'm going to read just verses 1 to 10 to start. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. Then he said, do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. And he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites. And now, behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression which the Egyptians oppress them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. Well, the burning bush, it's a massively popular one for children's Bible stories. I think you're going to be hearing that a lot through Summerlink. We've chosen the popular ones through this series. I think one of the problems, though, with the burning bush, or as we should be calling it, the not-so-burning bush, is that the writers, they're very good at retelling the story in the children's Bibles, but they're not really quite sure what to do with it once they've told it. They're brilliant at doing pictures as well. If you've seen any Bible picture story books on this sort of thing, I mean, you see pictures of Moses sort of gasping as the not-so-burning bush is there. Quite hard to sort of draw a picture of a bush like that. Some other pictures will home in on Moses taking off his shoes and sort of kneeling before this flame. Some try to depict a voice coming from the flames. And in an effort to make it personally relevant, many of these children's Bibles try to sort of make out that what's really going on is Moses is really scared. And thankfully, because of this personal encounter, he no longer feels like he's so ill-equipped, no longer has such small self-esteem. It's like they're saying everyone needs a burning bush moment. To be clear, that's not what this passage is actually saying. As I've already said, Moses is helping us to understand the God of the Bible. It's not really about Moses at all. It's about God and his revelation. That's what the book of Exodus is all about, teaching us what God is like, what God has planned. You see, our aim is not just to know lots of facts about God, but to know God. By this point in Exodus, God's people, the Israelites, are slaves. They've been going through a pretty horrendous period of history. Mistreatment, hard labor, genocide. It's their everyday experience. And yet, despite all of this, the first two chapters, which we haven't had time to read this evening, very obviously show God at work, raising up a future leader to deal with this predicament. God is not in any rush, though. God doesn't rush in as soon as there's a problem. Long periods of history pass where God doesn't seem to do anything. Between Genesis and Exodus, we've had a period of just over 400 years. Moses was born in the opening chapters of Exodus. He lived for 40 years in Pharaoh's house as a prince. Between chapter 2 and chapter 3, another 40 years pass. Now, 3 verse 1, Moses was keeping the flock. What a contrast to where he's been. He was a prince in Egypt, brought up in Pharaoh's palace. Now, 40 years later, he's an 80-year-old shepherd. Picture him with his grey, no doubt, long beard. Perhaps he's hard of hearing, sort of walking stick in hand. Not as nimble as the years in the past. It's just interesting to pause on this for a moment. Such long periods of time. 400 plus years, and then a leader is raised up. And then wait till he gets to 40, send him out into the desert, another 40 years looking after sheep. It's a long period of time. Why the delay? Well, I think we see the reason for the delay at the end of the section. It's worth noting that chapters 3 and 4 form a sort of unit in Exodus. And we really get the main application of chapter 3 and 4 right at the end. So just look at chapter 4, verse 29, just across the page there. And I'll read it out. You see, the start of the section, chapter 3, we get Moses sort of aimlessly wandering around. He's this shepherd, 80-year-old man. By the end of the section, look what happens, 4 verse 29. Moses and Aaron, that's his brother, went and gathered together all the elders of the people of Israel. Aaron spoke all the words that the Lord had spoken to Moses and did the signs in the sight of the people. And the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord had visited the people of Israel and that he had seen their affliction, they bowed their heads and worshipped. You see, God's purpose in delaying is so that just the right group of people could be assembled, who could be brought to a belief, a knowledge of him, not just things that he's done, but what he's like, what he plans to do. To know what he was like and to be confident that he was able to rescue them safely and take them all the way to the promised land. So you see, far from being a sort of personal burning bush moment, this is God's perfectly timed and very personal revelation of himself so that his people would believe, so that his people, end of chapter 4, would know what he is like, what he plans to do. So you see the first point there that we're going to make. First of two points, we're going to stop for discussion after each. God uniquely able to keep his promises. There is, of course, no adjective that can be placed in front of the word unique. God is unique and demonstrates that fact to Moses in a quite strange way. He speaks to him from this not-so-burning bush. His fire has one key feature, which is drawn to our attention at least twice. Look at the second half of verse 2. Moses looked, behold, the bush was burning, yet not consumed. And then verse 3, Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. It is a visual aid to help Moses, a visual aid to help us, if you like, an illustration to help us understand God's uniqueness. Now, Moses' background was pretty special. Already said, I mean, he spent 40 years in the palace, another 40 years looking after sheep. He'd had plenty of opportunities to see strange things. Plenty of opportunities to hallucinate. This is one of the strangest things he's ever seen. He can't wait to turn aside and make sense of this. It was in every sense a miracle, a supernatural event, a display of God's power, his vitality. You see, the fire needed no fuel. It was self-sufficient. It was self-maintaining. One writer says, a flame that was nourished by its own life. Teaching us something about God. God is not constrained by the natural forces and boundaries of the created order. When God reveals himself, he's perfectly at liberty to bend the rules of nature. In fact, it's one of the clearest ways of revealing himself to the world is to show that he doesn't fit the normal categories that the world is used to. Miracles help us to see exactly what, or we should say, who we are dealing with. I've had a number of conversations, I'm sure you have too, with people over the years who've who've said things like, well, I love all the things written in the Bible, but I just can't accept the miraculous things. Like the parting of the Red Sea. You know that bit where the water is just sort of piled up? I mean, that's ridiculous. That obviously didn't happen. Or as they come through, you know, the virgin birth. I mean, that's just people not really understanding what's going on. The resurrection. Jesus just lived on in the hearts of the disciples. These things are explained away. What I've said in the past is that miracles like the virgin birth, the Red Sea, the burning bush here in Exodus 3, they don't need to cause the Christian reader any problem at all, because, I mean, this is a very obvious way for the God who made this world to make himself known. It's made-up gods, or gods of our personal agenda, if you like, that have difficulty in doing miracles. It's usually because people want to make these sort of gods more acceptable, more palatable to the world around. The whole point is God stands apart from the world, entirely separate. He is unique. Unlike everything else in the world, God does not depend on the resources of the world for his existence. This isn't a trick of nature, but a living being, quite obviously from outside the natural order. And the rest of this section, I think, really underscores that point. You see, verse 5, Moses is told to take off his shoes because the place he is standing is holy ground. This is the first time since the fall of the world that the word holy has been used in the Bible. Holy just means separate or set apart. It's making the same point. God is entirely separate. He cannot be defined by reference to things in this world. But God's uniqueness is not meant to be abstract. Look at verse 6. And he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. You see, God wants this unique revelation at the burning bush to be connected to previous revelations, the ones that he'd given to the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. You read about all of them through Genesis. The point is, he is the same God, a God who speaks and makes promises. He first spoke to Abraham and promised to take him and his multitude of descendants safely to the promised land, to be their God, to bless them, to protect them all the way. And then he restates these promises. You get a few more details, but essentially it's just the same thing being restated again and again through the book of Genesis. Isaac gets the same promises. Jacob gets the same promises. They're handed to Joseph in the end. And the implication is that Joseph will hand them on to future generations, on and on, the same promises. God says, I'm that God. I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But really interestingly, this little quote is then picked up in the New Testament. Flick forward to Mark's Gospel, page 1023. Mark chapter 12, verse 26. And Jesus says, and as for the dead being raised, have you not read in the book of Moses, in the passage about the bush, how God spoke to him saying, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. Look at verse 27. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. It's fascinating. Jesus uses this Exodus text, the one that we just read, to prove that God is the God of the living, not of the dead. Well, how does that help us? Go back to Exodus chapter 3. You see, I think what's going on here is God is saying, as he speaks to Moses from the burning bush. So he's not saying, I made promises to Abraham, and then he died. And then I made promises to Isaac, and he died. And so that's why I had to make promises to Jacob, and he died. And I knew he was going to pass them on, but thankfully there's always some descendants. That's not the point at all. It's the absolute opposite. What God is saying to Moses in chapter 3 is that he made promises to Abraham, and he's still keeping those promises to Abraham. And then he made promises to Isaac and Jacob. And he's still keeping those same promises to Isaac and Jacob. Because Isaac and Abraham and Jacob are still very much alive. They're enjoying the true fulfillment. Those promises were made. Those promises have substance. those people, Moses, your forefathers, they're still enjoying those promises. And now, says God to Moses, I'm making promises to you, and I will keep my promises to you, just like I'm still keeping those promises to your forefathers. And of course, it's because of God, of who God is, that he is unique, this holy, set-apart God, not constrained by the forces of this world. Get this illustration, this wonderful burning bush, not burning, to make the whole point about God's character. It's because of this that we know that God is able to keep his promises. Well, I hope that's raised a few things just to think about and discuss. You'll see some questions there on the handout. And I've got a good sort of 10 minutes, and I'll draw us back, do the next little bit of Exodus in 10 minutes' time. Well, if I could just draw you back together. Although God has demonstrated his uniqueness to Moses, Moses isn't quite ready for what God says in verse 10. Have a look at verse 10. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people out of Egypt. It's quite a simple sort of task, really. Go to the most powerful man in the known world and tell him that he needs to let his 2 million slaves go. Nothing daunting about that, especially if you're an 80-year-old shepherd. Well, Moses' first reaction to everything he's heard so far, have a look at verse 11. Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? Well, let's read that in its context. So we'll read on from chapter 3, verse 11. I'll just go up to verse 17. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? And he said, but I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. Then Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I have observed you and what has been done to you in Egypt, and I promise that I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. It is easy to have some sympathy, isn't it, with verse 11, as Moses says, who am I? The task sounds impossible. And so how does God cure this? He gives him more revelation about himself. You'll see that second point on the handouts there. God is actively present with his people all the way to the promised land. Verse 12, the first thing God says to Moses, I will be with you. And I think lots of references then in this section to God's personal involvement. Verse 16, I've observed you. Nothing's escaped my attention. I know what's happened to my people, says God. Verse 17, I will bring you, says the Lord. God is with his people. And Moses objects again, verse 13, saying, he doesn't even know his name. How is he going to go to the known leader of the superpower world and doesn't even know his name? That's not going to sound very convincing. Now, this is not Moses saying, oh, by the way, I didn't quite catch your name. You know, when you're on the phone to your sort of someone in the bank or the insurance company, you think if there's any chance of getting this complete, I'm going to have a reference of his name just so I can pick up where I left off. That's not the point here. You see, in Moses' day, unlike our day, where we just have a little sort of point of ref, readers of Exodus know already names are hugely significant. In Exodus 2, two babies were born, and both times their names are explained. Moses, to draw out. Something which very obviously happened to him as he was drawn out of the Nile. Perhaps prefiguring also the work that Moses would do as he was lead his people out of Egypt, to draw them out. Gershom then, Moses' son, also born in chapter 2. Sounds like the Hebrew for sojourner. In other words, somebody not resident in the land, someone just passing through. Our names today don't seem to mean very much. We just choose names if we have the privilege of choosing names for children or whatever it is, because we like the sound of them. Some names do seem to have meaning. I checked with Paul just before we started. Some of you will know Paul Wong. He did basically most of the work behind the scenes to make this evening happen. And I said to Paul, so what does your name mean? What does Wong mean? And he said, he was very quick on this. The ancient meaning of Wong means king. And I said, yes. And what about the present meaning? And he was a little bit more hesitant. A royal color, which is, I said, yellow. So, not quite as glamorous as it first sounded. But you see, when the Bible was written, names hugely significant. When Moses asked God for his name, he was asking God to describe his very nature, the essence of his being, his character. What does God say? Verse 14, I am who I am. He said this, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. I am who I am, or I will be what I will be. In other words, God is saying that at the very heart of his being lies the fact that he is. One commentator describes this is God describing his isness. His isness. As human beings, we could never describe ourselves like this, obviously. You see, for myself, if I go back to the 60s, I can carefully say I wasn't. If I come to the 70s, 1970s, well, I could have said I am. Today, I can say I am. Tomorrow, hopefully, I can say I am. In 100 years, I can definitely not say I am. I could say I'll be dead in 100 years' time as far as this world is concerned. But you see, in contrast, God, on the other hand, at every point in time, and even before time, as we understand a scale of time, God is able to say, I am. He is the eternally present. I am. And that's because he doesn't depend on anyone else for life. He doesn't need a point of reference in this world. He's self-existent, self-sufficient. At every point in time, God has always been and will always be the same. Yesterday, I am. Today, I am. And when we've been with him in heaven for 10 billion years, God will be able to say, the best way of understanding me is by my name, I am. Now, some of you may have spotted a slight complication. Verse 15, it seems that God uses a different name for himself. Verse 15, God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, the Lord. It's a bit strange. He just used a different name. Now he's saying, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. So what is his name? Is his name I am who I am, or is it the Lord? Well, whenever we see the word Lord in capital letters, the Bible is translating the Hebrew name for God, which is spelt with four consonants, a YHWH in the original language. And so we often sort of add in a few extra vowels and rightly say Yahweh, or some older translations will translate it as Jehovah. That Hebrew name, Yahweh, Jehovah, sounds like the Hebrew for the verb to be. So in other words, every time we read the word Lord in capital letters, we should always think in our minds, this is God's name. This is Yahweh. So God's name, closely connected with the Hebrew verb to be, both in meaning and in sound. I think the footnotes sort of make sense of that if you want to follow up some of that in your own time. He is the eternal I am. And the point to teach us is that God is not some sort of antisocial living force, but that God is intimately and personally present in all situations, especially with his people. I think that's why he keeps on saying, I'm the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, actively present and still present, still keeping promises I am their God. I always will be their God. I am. Another commentator, in no situation is God an ornamental extra, in every situation actively present. So you see, for Moses, I mean, this rather daunting situation, the extraction of 2 million people from the world's superpower, Moses most needed God's assurance that he was not only with him, but that he would go with him all the way to the promised land. And God makes that point, doesn't he? You get it twice in the text, second half of verse 8, to bring them up out of the land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey. You see, God's always got the end game in his sights. It's not just a quick fix. Here's the end game. He first promised that to Abraham back in Genesis chapter 12. Always with his eyes on the future, the eternal, the promised land, a picture of heaven, of the new creation. You see it again in verse 17. I promise that I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the rest of them, a land flowing with milk and honey. You see, Moses was privileged to be given this revelation for the task at hand. How much more privileged are we all these thousands of years later? So much more. I mean, it's easy to see now, isn't it? Why Jesus caused such a stir when he broke onto the scene in the Gospels and brought the name of God to bear on himself. I am, he said. You remember this confrontation? Before Abraham was, I am, he said to the establishment. You see, at the end of Matthew's gospel, our assurance can reach new heights as we think of Jesus' final words to all who would follow him. Behold, I am with you always, even unto the end of the age. I've jotted down a few of those verses in the next discussion section. You can follow some of those up in a few minutes. But now as we draw threads, the not-so-burning bush. You see, it was given not simply to give Moses confidence or help him with his lack of self-esteem. The incident was there to record, to expand our understanding of God. In the system that God has designed in his economy, progressive revelation, a little bit more detail about who he is, what he has planned, is given to his people through time. This is a key moment. He's waited many hundred years to give it. This incident was recorded to expand our understanding of who God is, what he has planned, that he is uniquely able to keep his promises because he stands apart from the created order. No task is too much, not even the rescue and redemption, the salvation of his people. That he is a relational God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, actively present with his people, the Lord, the I am, stands in massive contrast to all of the pagan gods of Moses' day, of our day. And that when God makes promises to his people, he keeps them. He will bring his people safely all the way to the true and eternal promised land. You see, promises that are not just for this life, for the here and now, but are for tomorrow and for the next day. And for that last day, and even beyond, through the grave. God, who is actively present with his people all the way to the promised land. Well, I hope again that's given a few things to pick up and discuss. We've got about 12, 13 minutes to do that. Can I suggest you leave a good 5 minutes at the end to pray? I'll pop up just before 15 past to close everything off, so yeah, you've got about 15 minutes, including prayer, and I'll pop up and close us off then. If you'd just like to make that your last prayer. Time to draw to a close. Hope this evening has been useful. Do carry on conversations. No need to rush off immediately. Just a few notices as we formally draw to a close.